Hello, and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada's live stream for Thursday, July 31st. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleagues Ali Abunima, John Elmer, Tamara Nassar, and Asa Winstanley. It's day 664 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Coming up, we'll talk to filmmaker and reporter Rueda Amer in Gaza about the situation she and those around her are facing as Israel's deliberate starvation intensifies. Meanwhile, the governments of France, Britain, and Canada are among the latest to announce that they plan to recognize a Palestinian state in the coming weeks. Ali will look at the small print, arguing that these headline-grabbing initiatives may not be good news for the Palestinian people. Later on in the program, John will cover the latest resistance news from Gaza, including operations from Khan Yunis to Jabalia. But first, let's take a look at the news. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Israel has bombed and attacked areas across Gaza this week, killing at least 640 Palestinians and injuring more than 3,200 between July 23rd and July 30th, according to records from the Ministry of Health in Gaza. On Monday night, Al Jazeera's Tarek Abu Azoum stated that dozens were killed in the central areas of Gaza in what residents there described as one of the bloodiest nights in recent weeks. Quote, 30 Palestinians were killed in Nuseirat refugee camp after Israeli forces struck a number of residential houses. Among the victims are 12 children and 14 women, and witnesses say most of the victims arrived at Al-Awda Hospital torn to pieces due to the sheer force of explosions. Local accounts indicate that Israel used booby-trapped robots as well as tanks and drones during this attack. But elsewhere in Gaza, we also see a relative surge in air attacks, including in the designated safe zone of Al-Mawasi in southern Gaza, where a father and his three children were killed in an Israeli attack on a makeshift tent, Abu Azoum stated. Nearly 100 Palestinians were killed on Monday, July 28th, almost half of them killed while trying to obtain food aid, Al Jazeera stated. The Ministry of Health in Gaza stated that more than 110 Palestinians were killed on Tuesday, including 22 who were shot and killed at food aid points. On Wednesday, July 30th, medical sources reported that at least 75 Palestinians were killed by Israel, including 63 who were trying to acquire food. More than half of those aid seekers were killed in northern Gaza near the Zakim crossing, where 270 people were also injured. That crossing has been yet another area that Israeli forces have turned into a killing field, along with the U.S.-Israeli so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation aid points in southern Gaza. Journalist Anas Al-Sharif posted this video of Israeli forces firing on Palestinians near the Zakim crossing on July 28th, and just a warning that you'll hear a lot of gunfire. Though Israel allowed a trickle of aid trucks into Gaza this past week, as well as humiliating and dangerous airdropped parcels with the help of the compliant Jordanian army, Palestinians say that not only is it a drop in the ocean compared to the critical need of food, water, fuel, and medicine, but that it is a dehumanizing policy that is helping reinforce Israel's engineered social chaos and starvation across Gaza. On Tuesday, July 29th, the Gaza government media office stated that 109 aid trucks were, quote, subjected to looting and theft as a result of the security chaos that the Israeli occupation is systematically and deliberately perpetuating with the aim of thwarting aid distribution and depriving civilians of it. The Gaza Strip needs 600 aid and fuel trucks daily, which is the minimum required need for the most vital sectors, the media office said. The day before, on Monday, July 28th, the Gaza government media office reported that only 87 aid trucks entered, the majority of which were looted, quote, with direct and systematic Israeli complicity. The Israeli army then carried out what the Gaza government media office said was a complex massacre on Monday, when Israel, quote, initially refused to allow the trucks to enter, then targeted the aid supply points belonging to clans and families, resulting in the killing of 11 security personnel. After confirming their deaths, the occupation authorities opened the way for trucks to enter, only to fall into the hands of criminal gangs and thieves under their direct protection, including drones and live ammunition, which targeted civilians. On July 29th, Gaza's civil defense rescue worker Mohammed Abu Luay filmed himself near the Zakim crossing, where crowds of Palestinians tried to obtain flour from a few aid trucks that entered. Quote, people are coming back carrying bags of flour, and we are going to carry the martyred and wounded from the area people are returning from, he says. May God reward us. They're all coming back with bags of flour except us. Some carry bags of flour while others carry body bags.
الكل ماخذ طحين وراضة وين رايحين رنجيب الشهداء والصابات من نطح من هنا ترجع الله يكتب لنا الأجر يا رب الله يكتب لنا الأجر بس الكل محمل طحين ومروح إلا إحنا
ناس بتشيل طحين وناس بتشيل أكفان
ناس بتشيل طحين وناس بتشيل أكفان رسمي الناس شايلة طحين وناس بتشيل أكفان حسبي الله ونعم الوكيل يا شيخ.
On Wednesday, July 30th, more than 50 Palestinians were killed and 650 were injured when people headed to receive food aid again near the Zakim crossing, according to the Gaza government media office, which called it a bloody massacre. 112 aid trucks entered the Gaza Strip on Wednesday, most of which were subjected to looting and theft, the media office added. Quote, this bloody massacre and previous similar crimes once again confirms that the occupation is using hunger as a weapon of war, cold-bloodedly targeting civilians seeking sustenance, in flagrant violation of all international and humanitarian laws. While continuing to deny that it is intentionally starving Palestinians, the Israeli army bragged that it dropped aid parcels into Gaza this week. The Gaza government media office said that Israel carried out six airdrops on Tuesday. Of those six, quote, four fell in areas under the control of the Israeli occupation army or in neighborhoods from which citizens had previously been ordered to evacuate, exposing those present to direct targeting and killing. This renders these airdrops useless and even dangerous to the lives of starving citizens, end quote. The media office said that a limited airdrop operation on Monday, quote, did not exceed half a truckload of aid, and it landed in red combat zones east of the Tufah neighborhood and Jabalia, where the occupation army is present. These are areas that are completely inaccessible to civilians. Several European states also announced that they would take part in airdropping aid instead of forcing Israel to open the land crossings. Belgium announced that it was sending one plane carrying medical supplies and food worth about 600,000 euros to Jordan, quote, soon, and that Belgian officials would remain on standby to conduct further drops in coordination with Amman. This comes after Spain and Germany announced that they would also begin working with Jordanian officials to coordinate airdrops. But as Euromed Human Rights Monitor stated, addressing the starvation in Gaza cannot be achieved through superficial or gaudy measures, but requires an immediate end to the blockade and the opening of safe, stable land corridors to enable the regular and sufficient delivery of food, medicine, and fuel. The only real solution is safe, protected land corridors for aid delivery under UN supervision, Euromed added. 400 aid centers once operated in Gaza before Israel dismantled them. They must be restored. Anything less, including these air spectacles, is complicity in genocide. Airdrops aren't about saving lives. They're about masking a war crime and preserving control. Meanwhile, Israeli and American mercenary forces operating the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation sites continue to trap, injure, and kill starving Palestinians every day. More than 1,200 Palestinians have been killed and more than 8,000 have been injured trying to obtain aid since the GHF began its operations on May 27th, according to the health ministry in Gaza. A group of children who were kidnapped in late June by Israeli forces at a Gaza Humanitarian Foundation site in Rafah in southern Gaza were released this past week and described their brutal torture and detention in Israel's Sde Tamon concentration camp. According to the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, these 10 children joined thousands of other starving people desperately seeking food aid. However, PCHR reports, quote, they found themselves arrested after facing the risk of death under the Israeli army's fire. According to information obtained by PCHR, the 10 children arrived in miserable health conditions at Nasser Medical Complex in central Khan Yunis on July 24th. They had been released by the Israeli army weeks after their arrest near the aid distribution centers established by Israel. They were released via Karmi Abu Salem crossing following their detention and maltreatment, and then were taken to Khan Yunis with the aid trucks. One of the children testified to the Palestinian Center for Human Rights that at the time of the kidnapping, the Israeli soldiers beat him with his hands and a stick and forced him to take off his clothes. He said that he and the other children were all placed inside metal cages that were 1 square meter large, where it was impossible to lay down or sit comfortably, and were given rotten food to eat. Quote, they then took me to a barrack containing 4 rooms with steel mesh roofs and concrete floors, the child said. The rooms had beds without mattresses and only 1 blanket. We were forced to remain seated on the beds all day and were not allowed to move. 3 days later, I was taken to a concrete room where I stayed for 4 days. It seemed like a hatchery for chicks or rabbits, with 4 large and very hot yellow spotlights. There were 25 detainees inside. During our detention, Israeli special units raided and violently suppressed us on 5 occasions. They stormed the room at around 2 a.m., throwing stun grenades inside, beating us with sticks, and electrocuting us. Each raid lasted approximately 2 hours, marked by physical assault, intense fear, and deafening noise. I still bear visible marks of the electric shocks on my left hand. While in this room, I suffered from full body muscle spasms, convulsions, and 2 episodes of nosebleeds due to my chronic sinusitis. Despite repeated requests for medical attention, no care was provided. When I asked for help, soldiers mockingly told me to drink water to stop the bleeding. The child said that he was interrogated for a full week with daily sessions of 4-hour questioning about, quote, Hamas, tunnels, hostages, cameras, handmade bombs, and identifying houses in my residential area. The interrogator was dissatisfied with my answers because I had no answers to his questions. He beat me with his hands while my feet and hands were tied to a chair. Sometimes the interrogation was done without anger or threats because the investigator already knew detailed information about my family, which made me fear for them. He told me, you are in Sde Tamon prison. After the interrogation ended, I was taken to what is known as the disco room, where Hebrew songs were played loudly and the air conditioner was set to a high temperature. I was blindfolded and my hands and feet were tied to a pipe all day. I remained there for 7 days on the floor. I was given a very small amount of poor quality food and had to eat while handcuffed. They then returned me to the previous room, where I stayed until my release. Upon our arrival at Nasser Medical Complex, the doctors examined me. I was suffering from shortness of breath and severe muscle spasms. After x-rays and a respiratory steam treatment, I felt somewhat better. Later, my father and relatives arrived and took me with them to our tent. That's one of several testimonies that some of the 10 children provided to the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. Another American mercenary has spoken out about the death traps masquerading as the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation for the second time in as many weeks. Speaking to the news program Democracy Now! On Tuesday, Anthony Aguilar said that Palestinians said what Palestinians and human rights defenders have been saying since the GHF opened its killing fields in late May, that these sites are designed to lure, trap, hunt, and kill Palestinians with impunity.
Sites have not only become death traps, they were designed as death traps. All four distribution locations were intentionally, deliberately constructed, planned, and built in the middle of an active combat zone. Some may argue, well, all of Gaza is a war zone. That may be true, but there are parts of Gaza that are direct or that are determined to be active operational combat zones where Israeli defense forces are operating. Those sites were built in the middle of those areas intentionally. It's not by accident. That in and of itself, to designate humanitarian distribution sites to service an unarmed, starving population, to build them deliberately in an active combat zone, is a violation of the Geneva Convention protocols. It's a violation of humanitarian law. And in my opinion, it's a violation of humanity in general. The sites, not only where they were built, all four sites around the perimeter and the roads leading in and out are barricaded by razor wire.
That was Anthony Aguilar. As of July 30th, Israel's engineered starvation in Gaza has killed at least 154 Palestinians, including 89 children, according to records by the Ministry of Health in Gaza. The Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, or IPC, an international body which monitors food insecurity and the crisis of starvation, warned this week that, quote, the worst-case scenario of famine is currently playing out in the Gaza Strip. Conflict and displacement have intensified, and access to food and other essential items and services has plummeted to unprecedented levels. Mounting evidence shows that widespread starvation, malnutrition, and disease are driving a rise in hunger-related deaths, the IPC stated, adding that the latest data indicates that famine thresholds have been reached for food consumption in most of the Gaza Strip and for acute malnutrition in Gaza City. One in three individuals are going without food for days at a time, the IPC states. Between May and July 2025, the proportion of households experiencing extreme hunger has doubled. The food consumption threshold for famine, what's known as Phase 5, has already been passed for most areas of the Gaza Strip. The IPC said that, quote, immediate action must be taken to alleviate the catastrophic suffering of people in Gaza. This includes scaling up the flow of goods, restoring basic services, and ensuring safe, unimpeded access to sufficient life-saving assistance. None of this is possible unless there is a ceasefire. For infants and children, the effects of severe malnutrition and starvation are becoming catastrophic. Ahmed Al-Farah, the director of pediatrics and maternity at Nasser Medical Complex, told Al Jazeera on Tuesday that his staff are seeing babies so malnourished that they don't have muscles and fat tissue anymore, just skin over bones. Al-Farah said that babies with severe malnutrition are experiencing decreased pancreatic enzyme secretions, leaving them more prone to lethal infections. The long-term effects of the lack of folic acid, B1 complex vitamins, and fatty acids that are essential for the composition of the central nervous system can also hinder or stop critical neurological developments. And if they survive, it can make it hard for a child to read or write or achieve normal cognitive growth later in childhood. 4-month-old Zainab Abu Halib died from being starved by Israel this week. Here's Dr. Ahmed Al-Farah talking about his tiny patient.
من بين ايدينا بتضيع ولا حياه لمن تنادي يعني عليكم انا والده زينب ابو حليب بنتي كانت بتعاني من جرثومه في الدم بعدين اكتشفنا معها انسداد في الامعاء ثقب في الامعاء عملنا لها عمليه استكشاف في الاوروبي وشالوا لها الزايده وحتى الان ما بنعرف اذا العمليه ناجحه او لا بنتي صار معها سوء تغذيه لدرجه ما بتقدر ترضع اي شيء منها إلا عن طريق السرنجة البربيش من أنفة للمعدة وأرجو يعني المشهد العاجلة لإنقاذ زينب وكانت 5 كيلو الآن صارت 2 كيلو على عمر 4 شهور يعني ما بعرف إيش أحكي، يعني الطفلة من بين إيدينا بتضيع ولا حياة لمن تنادي يعني، وهيها عايشة على اللهاية. بنطالب السفارة الأردنية، بنطالب كل إنسان له ضمير حي وإنسان محترم وإنسان يقدر يساعد هالطفلة يعني للخروج برا. إحنا عملنا لها التحويل وبنتمنى منكم أنتوا تقدروا تساعدونا في الخروج ده برا، لأنه كتير في حالات صعبة هنا وما حدا بيناشد ولا حدا يعني ما حدا بيساعدنا في هذه الحالة. بناشد منظمة الصحة العالمية بالإسراع لإنقاذ طفلة زينب، ولأنها بتضيع من بين إيدينا، وياريت تلبوا احتياجات هذه الطفلة، لأنه ما صار معها سوء تغذية شديد وما حدا قادر ينقذها الطفلة. بتمنى أنكم تعالجوها بالقريب العاجل، لأنه البنت ما بتقدر ترضع نهائي، وهي عايشة على الحليب ولا ما فيش حليب إنه أساساً أنا نتعيش عشانه يعني.
Sorry, that I had the wrong video, but that was a video of Dr. Ahmed Al-Fara's tiny patient, four-month-old Zainab Abu Halib, who died from being starved this week in Gaza. Dr. Tanya Haj Hassan, a physician with Doctors Without Borders, told Al Jazeera that serious health risks remain even after food becomes available again. Quote, all of the cells in your body are altered by this. In the intestines, the cells die, she said, adding that heart cells become weak and thinned, absorption of vitamins and fats becomes difficult, and children often die of heart failure, even when they're being refed. Euromed Human Rights Monitor reported this week that another vulnerable population, Palestinian elders, are also dying from starvation. Quote, approximately 1,200 elderly Palestinians have died in the past 2 months due to Israel's starvation policy, malnutrition, and lack of medical care, all of which have intensified in recent days. But the actual death toll may be significantly higher, Euromed says. Quote, in reality, these deaths result from deliberate starvation policies and the systematic dismantling of the health system, forming a pattern of intentional killing prohibited under international humanitarian and criminal law. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight the terrifying experience of trying to get aid in Gaza by Rifat Ibrahim, writing from Gaza. Rifat documents his journey that he took in early June to one of the U.S.-Israeli so-called aid sites. He writes, quote, I knew we were close to the aid site when I saw a large mass of people gathered in front of me. It had taken us all night to get here. My friend Saada Abu Saada and I had left Al-Mawasi near Khan Yunis at 1:30 a.m. and headed south on the coastal road, Al-Rashid Street, toward Rafah. Neighbors in Al-Mawasi had told us to get to the aid site as early as possible, because there were not enough provisions for everyone. We thought that by leaving this early, we had a chance to get food. We walked slowly. On our left were miserable rows of tents. On our right was the seashore, calm on the surface, but with Israeli gunboats lined up along the horizon, close enough to be visible with the naked eye. We were not alone in our walk. Many others were headed the same way. An elderly man leaned on his cane and said in commiseration, how hard it is to be hungry. We had 12 kilometers ahead of us, a potentially reasonable distance for a well-fed and nourished person, but we were neither well-fed nor nourished. We walked slowly from exhaustion and hunger. The only calories fueling my body were from scant amounts of lentils and pasta that I had obtained with great difficulty and effort in previous days. My mother, brother, and 5 sisters were back at our tent in Al-Mawasi. Dizzy from hunger, they could barely move. I could no longer bear to see my family wither from starvation. That's why I was walking along the coastal road in the dark on Eid al-Adha, June 6th, tired and hungry, headed toward a so-called American aid center, a place that had declared itself on its social media page as a source of relief. The aid sites run by the American and Israeli-run Gaza Humanitarian Foundation only opened on May 27th, but by early June, it was understood already in Gaza that they were also death sites. Israeli troops were shooting and killing us. Yet the more news spread about these massacres, the more news spread about the aid sites themselves. It is a cruel irony that we are so starved that in the news of massacres, we also hear that there is food available and that there is a possibility that we might get some if we can only survive the site itself. Here we die of hunger, Saad said, and there we may die of bullets. Those are excerpts from The Terrifying Experience of Trying to Get Aid in Gaza by Rifat Ibrahim, writing from Gaza on electronicintifada.net. And finally, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Palestine. Musician and music teacher Ahmed Mouin posted this video of a lesson with two of his students. He captions this clip, quote, "Despite the hardship and the shadow of war, my students Amal and Sara have shown incredible dedication. For the past 4 months, they've been training with me and their progress has been remarkable. Now playing with confidence and emotion. In the darkest times, music remains our light." That's from Ahmed Mouin with his students Amal and Sara. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You're watching the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleague Ali Abunima. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Nora. Thank you. You know, it's day after day, week after week, yeah. We don't even show the worst. We don't show the worst of the images that are coming out of Gaza. People are seeing them. Day after day, rows of emaciated bodies, shot, killed. I just saw some images from one of our colleagues in Gaza, Muhammad Asad, that we probably wouldn't be able to show and keep the channel on air. It's just unbelievable. It's unbelievable. We're going to talk a lot about everything today, but I just want to acknowledge just the horror that people are seeing every day and feeling powerless to stop it, and just remind people, as we will throughout this program, that you're not powerless. Keep speaking out, and we'll hear that message in the next segment, which we recorded a little bit earlier with Rueda Amer, the filmmaker and writer, a frequent contributor to the Electronic Intifada. We were able to reach her in Gaza and talk to her, and she'll make very clear the importance of our voices right now to people in Gaza. So why don't we go to our interview with Rueda?
Perfect. Thanks, Ali.
We're now going straight to Gaza, where we're joined by Rueda Amer. She's a writer, a filmmaker, a journalist, and a longtime contributor to the Electronic Intifada. Welcome, hi. Rueda.
Hi,
welcome. Hi.
Thank you for joining us, Rueda, during a very, very difficult situation. Just to start, tell us what the situation is now for you and for those around you in Gaza.
Yeah, Gaza now is in very hard situation because we are in very hard hunger. Okay, so all the people or all the news focus on the hunger in Gaza. So hunger is very bad feeling to be human, as a human, in the world in 2025 and don't find anything to eat. And there's people die because there's no food in their homes. And their parents can't to get food for them. So now we are suffering from many things in Gaza. Still displacement from our homes. Also the bombing around us. I didn't sleep last night because there is huge bombing around me in Khan Yunis city. And also the hunger. The bad thing is hunger. If you will not die from the bombing, you will die from the hunger. Do not find any food in the market to eat. To like the normal people can eat three meals in one day, okay? But we are not half meal in one day, okay? Really, for I'm talking about myself.
Can I ask you, Ruwaida, when is the last time you ate? I'm sorry to ask you such a personal question, but we want people to know what the situation is. When is the last time you ate?
Okay, I want to tell about myself today. Every day, as I told you, I eat just one meal, okay? Mm-hmm. But there is many people don't eat even one meal or anything in their day, okay? So there's people suffering worse than me. So this thing is so bad because I'm hearing around me in the Khan Yunis camp the sounds of the children crying. They want to eat. We want bread. We want. I'm yesterday, or I don't know, maybe today, I had one of my relatives said, I hope to get a lot of potato, a lot of tomato, a lot of. They wish to see the vegetables, the fruit, meat, and everything. So we wish to see the food really in Gaza. Okay, I want to say something. It's very important. Okay, yesterday. And I think from 2 days, they said we will enter the aid and the food to Gaza from Karam Abu Salim, I don't know, or Rafah crossing, okay? But there's no food. Until now, there's no food in the market, or we don't get any food, okay? Because there is no security in Gaza. Before the war, everything can enter to Gaza with safety, okay? But now there is no security can save everything in Gaza. So we are living like there is no one can control of the trucks enter to Gaza, okay? So mafias and thieves attack the trucks and take all the aids or all the food from the trucks, and the people can't go take anything. Also, there is American centers, okay, so maybe you know that the people yesterday, this hospital, Nasser Hospital, received more than 10 people killed by the centers of AIDS in different places in Khan Yunis city in Khan Yunis city. So it's so terrible. We need to end this or stop this war because the food can enter to Gaza with safe. There is no one control in Gaza Strip. There is bombing every time. There is no good places. Also, the tracks of food enter to Gaza in like red areas or dangerous areas, okay? So when the people go there to take any food or anything, they attack them, okay? And they kill them. So we need to stop this war and back to the food into Gaza as normal we used to before the war. But this way, it's not benefit the people in Gaza. It's still there is hunger. There's no one get food until now.
Rueda, I just want to ask you, you said that you're lucky to eat one meal a day.
Yeah.
And you talked about people dreaming about having vegetables or tomatoes or meat, which is unavailable. Let me ask you, and again, this is just to inform people about the reality in the world. What are you eating? What, when you have that one meal a day, what's available to you?
Nothing, just beans. I hate them, by the way. My mother is very suffering from the beans, okay? Because like food, falafel, everything, it's not benefit our bodies. I am very tired when I walk just a few meters, okay? Sometimes I said I will not work because my work need to think more, and I need to thinking about my articles, my videos, but that need energy, but I don't have energy. I don't, like, I want to sleep a lot of my time during the day. Okay, so don't think about if there's meal, not like there's meat, there is fish, there is no. It's very simple food. I think if there is any child aged 1 year, it will not be good for him. He will ask more and more and more food to be good, okay, and feel I'm full now. But no, it's 1 meal, but it's not benefit my body because there is no types of food. Also, there is a very, very few vegetables in the market, but very expensive, too expensive, like 1 kilo tomato, $40. Yes, it's too much, okay? And I want to say something to Gaza Strip health farmers, yeah? You know, has sea also. So we can fishing and we can eat fish and we can growing many types of vegetables or fruits and we can eat. But they bulldozed a lot of farmers in Gaza Strip and occupied many farmers in Gaza Strip, and they don't allow for any fisherman to enter to the sea. They attacked anyone go to the beach of Gaza Strip, and you know, said that no one go to the beach. If anyone go to the beach in Gaza Strip, they will target them or they will kill them. So it's so hard, okay? So just we have just one way to get the food, enter, open, stop this war and open the crossing to enter the trucks with safety ways, and all the people in Gaza Strip can get the food. But during the bombing, under the bombing, during the war continue, we will not get anything.
No, Rueda, can you talk about, you know, these European countries, Germany and now Spain, through working with Jordan, are now doing these like aid drops again. They're flying over and then dropping these parcels of food that are, you know, really it's for optics, you know, it's for the cameras. It's so that Israel can say, look, we're allowing these aid drops to happen as they, as you said, continue to seal the land crossings, the safest and easiest and cheapest and most effective way to get food into Gaza, especially at this time. Can you talk about the aid drops and this whole like circus around it? What you're seeing, what you're hearing from people, are these parcels doing anything to alleviate the, you know, catastrophic starvation situation in Gaza?
I know. I want to say something. I want to say thank you for any country thinking about us and want to help to solve this hunger situation, okay? But I told you, nothing will benefit the people in Gaza just to stop this war. But I know, I saw the plants, drops, the AIDS in Gaza, because I'm near Mawasikh and Yunus, so I know that I saw there. But it's not safety for the people, because maybe that they will drop it on the head of the people, on the tent, okay? And money, a lot of them dropped in the dangerous area, so no one will go there and take get the food from these areas, because, you know, the occupation target is anyone go there. So as I told you, we know there is money thinking from the money countries to help the Palestinian people in Gaza Strip to solve this hunger. But I'm one of the people living in Gaza, and I see all everything happening around me and see what's the tracks of food coming or enter to Gaza Strip. What's happening for them? I also see that the people who go to American centers for AIDS, what's happening for them? And I see also the planet dropping the food in Gaza. But we are 2 million. We are not just 100. No. You need to solve this problem for 2 million. I want the people to think this way will help to feed all the 2 million. About my family, they don't go to any one of the three services, okay, like for plan or for tracks or for American centers, no, because it's very dangerous. We know that it's not safe. It's mm-hmm. dangerous. So, I want to say again, thank you for every country. Any people want to help us, but we want to do our work more and more to stop this war. Mm.
I want to ask you about that. What do you see? We ask this question whenever we are fortunate enough to speak with someone in Gaza. Do you and the people in Gaza see what's happening around the world? Do you see people protesting? And what's your message to people around the world? What should they be doing right now?
Okay. I want to say we are so strong when we see the people protest for Gaza. They want Gaza to be free. They want to the war stop. So that make us strong, and that give us hope. There is the situation will change anyway, and we see the protest in the countries about the hunger in Gaza, and they say no for the hunger in Gaza. So I want to say for the people, as I told you before, the people in Gaza are so tired. They need to take rest from everything. They need this war to stop and back to normal life. Our normal life before the war will not back. We know that because the war destroyed everything. But we need to sleep without bombing. We need to eat very well. I last 2 days or 3 days, I lost my mind. I want to anything sugar, okay? I need energy for my body. I can't think about anything. And I told my mother, I will lose my mind. I want anything sugar to eat. I didn't eat sugar for more than 1 month or 2 months, okay? So it's too much, okay? So I need that because I need to have energy. So sometimes I feel like I want to sleep. I took like about my experience as a sample, but there is many stories, and there are 2 million stories. Also, other stories about my mother. My mother was very sick and need to make to do like an operation. Okay, last 2 months, but we postponed this operation because we know we are displaced. We displaced our home. We need to back and think about this operation. But her doctors said no. She will lose her move if she can't. She didn't make this. This operation, but she do that, okay? Now she need to recover from her operation. There is no food to make her strong and to be her health good and improve in her health. No, because she need eat, she need food, good food to be strong, to be good, to back to her health, okay? Like this, to see her health, there is change before and after operation, but until now, no, there's no food. I'm so worried about her. I told her, be patient, they will enter the food and we will pay anything. She told me it's too expensive, but I said, it's okay. It's okay. If I can buy anything for my mother, very simple thing, but it's too expensive, okay? But I need my mother to be survive it, okay? And that I need her to be good during this bad situation. We are in very bad situation more than any time. So we need the people to still talk about Gaza. Keep your eyes on Gaza because we deserve to live in just, we need to take rest from everything around us. Really, it's too much.
Rueda, we're praying for your mother's health, and it's hard enough to face an operation, even with a good situation, but to face it in this situation, it's unimaginable, and we all send our best wishes and our love for your mother, and we pray for her good health. You are now in a hospital. Talk about what you're seeing in the hospital in terms of the situation there for doctors, for patients, for staff. What's it like in the hospital where you are?
Yeah, I saw that it has a lot of patients. Also, I want to say my mother didn't sleep in the hospital just one night because there's no places in the hospital for any patient. Okay, there is a lot of injuries. Okay, there's a lot of patients, and also the people, the doctors in the hospital are very tired. They can't complete their work because they can't complete their work, okay, because they also need food, okay? They need energy to complete their work. They are like trade maybe more than 100 people in the hospital because the bombing every time, okay? I heard that, and I'm seeing that in the hospitals, okay? So also, the hospital is very, very tired. The people in the hospital are very tired. They need food. And my friend, his doctor, he told me, I go to the market and make a lot of tour in the market to find a simple thing and eat to complete my work, but I didn't find. I didn't find. And sometimes I saw my colleagues sit on the chair when they talk with the patient or the people in the hospital because they need to take rest and complete. So also the people, the doctors, all the people in Gaza are very hungry, need to eat very well to complete their life. Okay, so you know, if you are hungry for more than 3 days, 4 days, 1 week, you will lose your health, your life. So it's equal with the bombing. So you know that, yeah.
Rueda, we'll let you go in a few minutes because we know that your time is precious and you need to conserve your energy. But what do you see around you? What does Khan Yunis look like these days? Are children able to play in the streets? Are people, you know, able to feel like there's still like a huge community? What is the mood like? You know, it's the height of summer. It's hot. It's sticky. Oh. What is it like in Khan Yunis?
Yeah. Khan Yunis city. Okay, there's a lot of people in Khan Yunis city because, you know, they like forced the people to displace their areas to Khan Yunis in Mawasi. Okay. And it's very hot. Very, very, very hot. I didn't sleep from this situation. Also, the people in the tent, they're very hot, and I don't know how I can describe. There's many pollution around us. The smell of the bombings, it's too hard. Last night, they bombed near my place, okay, and I heard the rocks dunched on the around me, okay, and there's something hit my head, okay, and I didn't sleep. I smelled there's bad thing around me, like bombings, explosions, okay, like this. Also the hunger, okay, the people there, they are very nervous, they are very lazy, they are very tired. When you walk in the street, you will see the people sit on the street. They want to take rest and complete the walking. Why we are walking, by the way? Because there is no taxis or cars in the street. There is no full enter to Gaza, okay, to be the cars working in the street. So if you want to go anywhere, you need to walk maybe more than 1, 2, 3 cables, okay? For me, I can't. I just say, I told my family, I will not go anywhere. I'm very tired. I can't do that. If I want, now I'm coming, I come to the hospital, I feel very tired. I'm talking with very, very hard. If you hear my breath, my sound, you will feel I'm so tired because I spend a little energy with the walking when I come to the hospital. So no, the mood in Khan Yunis city or on the all areas in Gaza Strip so bad because the war is very hard, and there is no hope to stop this war. The people following the news about the agreement, what's happening between Hamas and Israel in Qatar or in Egypt or in USA, but there's no hope. Our routine, when we are woke up, okay, what's happening in the news? There is hope to get to hear there is ceasefire or not. Sometimes they say yes, sometimes they say no, because we are focused on Trump speech. Positive thing, we say, there is ceasefire coming very soon. When he said anything bad, we said, no, there is no ceasefire coming soon. So we want to solve this thing, okay? We need to stop this war, because if the war caring about the Gaza Strip, okay, or the people in Gaza Strip, work very hard to stop this war. Because I'm hearing about, I didn't hear anything to talk about the children in Gaza. the people in Gaza, people, I don't know how they look at to Gaza Strip. We are people, we are human, we are like anyone, we have a dream, we have future, we have families, we want to save them from everything around us, bombing, displacement, and now hunger, it's too much. No one in the world can able to be with this situation one day, not 2 years. Yeah. Okay, so it's too much. So now there is bombing. I heard explosion near the hospital. So it was very hard.
Rueda, we are praying for your safety and for everyone there. It's we're so grateful to you to share with us what's happening and to let people know, even though it's very difficult for you personally to move anywhere, to travel safely, to find internet, but you did it because you wanted people to know what's happening, and we are so grateful for that. What I want to say to you is we want a ceasefire for you and for everyone in Gaza more than anything. And I can't tell you when that's going to happen because we're waiting like everyone else. We hear Trump say something positive, and then the next day he says the opposite. And we don't know any more than you what will happen. But I can tell you this, the outrage, the anger, the protests about what is being done to people in Gaza by Israel and by the supporters of Israel, that anger is more than ever now. More people are speaking out than ever. And we will continue to do that. We promise to keep doing that. We won't forget about Gaza. We won't stop talking about Gaza. Thank you for sharing this, your experience with us, because that helps us to educate people around the world who are watching this. And I hope the next time we speak to you, Rueda, and it will be soon, I hope there will be a ceasefire and this nightmare will come to an end. And in the meantime, we hope you stay safe. We pray for you, for your mother, especially for all your family. And we hope to talk to you again very soon.
Inshallah, thank you so much. And I want to say thank you for anyone thinking about Gaza, about the people in Gaza. And I want to say the war is not good solution for any problem in the world. Peace, it's the best way in the world. So I hope the people back to this point and thinking too much about this and give us our safety. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rueda. Thank you for everything. And we hope to have you back on very, very, very soon.
Inshallah.
With better news.
Inshallah. I hope that.
Take care, Rueda. Be thank safe. You. Get home okay, safe. Get to your family safely. Bye-bye. Thank you.
A very, very difficult and moving interview with our contributor, Rueda Amer.
And Rueda, like Dunya last week, had to travel some distance. To
by foot, yeah.
Yes, and with little energy. She talked about that in the interview, but also before, how difficult it is to do anything. And I've heard that from other colleagues in Gaza who say they now count their steps to move around as little as possible to preserve their energy. It's just unbearable. And the most unbearable thing, and we hear this time and again, is watching your loved ones, your children, elders, your parents, your grandparents suffering starvation, which of course is made even worse when people have chronic illnesses. And it's just unimaginable.
Yeah.
And Rueda had asked, she had said that she wanted to come and speak to the viewers and listeners and readers of the Electronic Intifada. She said she felt a need to speak out and let people know what was happening. And we're very privileged to have provided her with that platform.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is a privilege and an honor. And it is, excuse me, it's just to see our friends and colleagues like Rueda and Dunya, Asim, and so many others in Gaza who are writing for us and who we check in on all the time, being tortured in this way over and over and over again for nearly 2 years, amidst, you know, a century of torture.
Yeah.
By the Israelis.
I was talking with a colleague the other day about Dr. Rifat al-Ar'ir, and how thin he looked on his last interviews with us. And that was like in November of 2023. People were already suffering from hunger, and how long ago was that? How long ago was that?
Yeah. It seems like both yesterday and a century ago. It's all unbearable. And you know, this is why we do this work, Ali. And meanwhile, of course, those with the power to stop this genocide and hold Israel to account, send Israel to The Hague, are effectively twiddling their thumbs. They're doing these, you know, really dangerous almost meaningless airdrops instead of forcing Israel to stop the siege and throw open the gates. And they're also, now there's this whole theater in New York this week at the UN about a supposed two-state solution conference. I mean, because that's what Palestinians need, right? Right now. Ali, you've been watching this closely. You wrote a book 20 odd years ago called One Country about the colonial fantasy of this two-state solution. Tell us what's going on in New York and what we should be watching carefully.
Thanks, Nora. And for those who are just joining us, I'm Ali Abu Nu'man. You're watching the Electronic Intifada live stream. Earlier this week, there was indeed a three-day meeting at the UN headquarters in New York called the High-Level International Conference for the Peaceful Settlement of the Question of Palestine and the Implementation of the Two-State Solution. It was organized by France and Saudi Arabia. And let's start with a clip of UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres addressing the conference.
Let's be clear. The creeping annexation of the occupied West Bank is illegal. It must stop. The wholesale destruction of Gaza is intolerable. It must stop. Unilateral actions that would forever undermine the two-state solution are unacceptable. They must stop. The two-state solution remains the only framework rooted in international law, endorsed by the Assembly and supported by the international community.
Yeah, so this comes as France leads a new push for recognition of a Palestinian state that has been joined by the UK and now Canada, among other staunch supporters of Israel's genocidal regime. And of course, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer announced that his country will maybe follow France's lead. And so let's take a look at a couple of clips from his announcement on Tuesday. Let's look at that first clip.
On the 7th of October, 2023, Hamas perpetrated the worst massacre in Israel's history. Every day since then, the horror has continued. The hostages are still being held today. The Palestinian people have endured terrible suffering. Now, in Gaza, because of a catastrophic failure of aid, we see starving babies, children too weak to stand, images that will stay with us for a lifetime.
So that clip, the reason we'll get to his declaration about the statement, but about recognizing his tape, but I just wanted to point out here that the language he uses, this very strong condemnation of the October 7th operation, which he characterizes the worst attack ever on Israel, and how he characterized what was happening to Palestinians in Gaza. He talked about a catastrophic failure of aid. Aid failed? What does that even mean? It's just bizarre. The refusal to name who is actually doing this. Now let's look at him actually talking about a Palestinian state.
Said that we will recognize a Palestinian state as a contribution to a proper peace process at the moment of maximum impact for the two-state solution. With that solution now under threat, this is the moment to act. So today, as part of this process towards peace, I can confirm the UK will recognize the state of Palestine by the United Nations General Assembly in September, unless the Israeli government takes substantive steps to end the appalling situation in Gaza, agree to a ceasefire, and commit to a long-term sustainable peace, reviving the prospect of a two-state solution.
So it's strange there how he's talking about recognizing a Palestinian state as a bargaining chip, and he might not do it if Israel lets in a few more trucks to Gaza. So this for him isn't about any fundamental Palestinian rights. He's prepared to sacrifice his supposed principled commitment to Palestinian statehood if Israel is willing to just ease the starvation for a bit. But the bigger point here is that many people think that this UN conference and these move towards recognition represent support for the Palestinian cause, because it sounds good. I've heard people saying, wow, France and Britain and Canada and other countries are going to recognize Palestine. That's a real gain in the minds of many people. And this is reinforced by the staunch opposition of the United States, which denounced the UN move or the UN conference. And we see this in a statement from the spokesperson for Secretary of State Rubio, absolutely excoriating this conference and the announcement of Macron, the French president, that France will recognize a Palestinian state. But I would argue that despite this apparent hostility, the US is very much on the same side as France, Britain, and Canada, and the others. The version of Palestinian statehood being pushed at this UN conference and by governments like France, Saudi Arabia, the UK and other Arab countries is a fundamentally anti-Palestinian project aimed at eliminating resistance to Israeli settler colonialism and ensuring the long-term survival of Israel even after it perpetrates this Holocaust. All you need to do is read the statements and documents from the states involved, and there are a couple I want to look at now that will give us guidance. We have to get down into it a little bit. Let's look first at this headline from the Times of Israel from July 30th. And we can see the headline there. In first, entire Arab League condemns October 7th, urges Hamas to disarm at two-state confab. And we can see that what the Times of Israel reports is that Arab and Muslim countries, including Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Egypt, Jordan, and Turkey, signed a declaration condemning for the first time Hamas's onslaught of October 7th and calling on the Palestinian terror group to release all the hostages it is holding, disarm, and end its rule of Gaza in a bid to end the devastating war in the Gaza Strip. 17 countries plus the 22-member Arab League and the entire European Union threw their weight behind a seven-page text obtained by the Times of Israel, agreed at a United Nations conference. That's the conference we're talking about. They're calling this the so-called New York Declaration. And now here is that seven-page document obtained by the Times of Israel. It's a draft for a so-called outcomes document from this conference. It is co-signed by France and Saudi Arabia as the co-chairs of the conference, or as the conveners of the conference, and is signed by all the co-chairs, which includes the Arab League and the other Arab and Muslim countries named by the Times of Israel. It is addressed to other members of the UN, asking them to endorse the document and to reply by writing to the Saudi mission at the UN no later than September 5th. And the document does indeed contain what the Times of Israel says, a call for a demilitarized Palestinian state under the control of a collaborationist Palestinian authority. I'm not going to go through the whole document because it's long, but I just want to point out a couple of key paragraphs. And this is paragraph 11. And it says, governance, law enforcement, and security across all the Palestinian territory must lie solely with the Palestinian Authority with appropriate international support. We welcome the one state, one government, one law, one gun policy of the Palestinian Authority and pledged our support to its implementation, including through the necessary DDR process that should be completed within an agreed mechanism with international partners and a set time frame. In the context of ending the war in Gaza, Hamas must end its rule in Gaza and hand over its weapons to the Palestinian Authority. Now, a couple of points about this. DDR stands for disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration. It talks about Hamas disarming and handing over its weapons to the Palestinian Authority in the context of ending the genocide. In other words, this document appears to accept Israel's view that the war, as they would call it, will go on until Hamas is demilitarized and disarmed. Total disarmament of the resistance is to be done before the creation of a demilitarized Palestinian state, because note that the weapons are to be handed over not to the government of an independent Palestinian state, but to the Palestinian Authority that exists under and collaborates with Israeli occupation. So this is about leaving Palestinians defenseless in the face of a genocidal occupier, first, by disarming any resistance, and second, at some point in the future, creating a demilitarized Palestinian state in name that cannot defend itself. So it's not about Palestinian self-determination, but about fulfilling Israel's war goals under the guise of a peace process. Nowhere does the document talk about disarming Israel. It doesn't even talk about disarming Israel's settlers in the West Bank who continue to terrorize and murder Palestinians every single day. The framework is about creating safety and security for the genocidal settler colony that is perpetrating a Holocaust. I want to look at one more point to illustrate how dangerous and anti-Palestinian this so-called two-state solution framework is. In particular, it seeks to abrogate the right of return of Palestinian refugees to their country and to their homes. And here's paragraph 14 of that same seven-page document co-signed by Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Qatar, Turkey, and the Arab League. It says that I'm just going to read this bit concerning UNRWA. Upon the achievement of a just solution to the Palestinian refugee issue to be agreed upon in accordance with UN General Assembly Resolution 194, UNRWA will hand over its public-like services in the Palestinian territory to empowered and prepared Palestinian institutions. So the document, it talks about achievement of a just solution to the Palestinian refugee issue without mentioning or reaffirming the right of return. And this is long-established peace process code for abrogating the right of return, resettling Palestinian refugees outside Palestine so that Jewish demographic supremacy is not threatened, and at best, refugees would get monetary compensation. It makes a passing reference to UN Resolution 194, but this should provide no reassurance since 194 is supposed to be about the right of return, but they don't mention that. They're only interested in the compensation part of 194. Now, this is key. We've all been told for the past 2 years that Israel's efforts to dismantle UNRWA are a red line, and all these governments are saying how they support UNRWA and UNRWA is essential. Well, this document talks about UNRWA, quote unquote, handing over its duties, not to the government of an independent Palestinian state, but to what it calls prepared and empowered Palestinian institutions in the Palestinian territory. In other words, all this appears to take place prior to the supposed independence of a Palestinian state. So again, this is a formula for dismantling any international institutions and frameworks that protect Palestinian rights and achieving Israel's war goals under the guise of diplomacy. Now, I'm not going to go into much more detail about this document, which is bad enough, but it gets even worse when you look at a statement published just yesterday, July 30th, by the French Foreign Ministry, making many of the same points and really laying out what the actual agenda is. This is a joint statement from the foreign ministers of Andorra, Australia, Canada, Finland, France, Iceland, Ireland, Luxembourg, Malta, New Zealand, Norway, Portugal, San Marino, Slovenia, and Spain. I'm naming names. A subset of the countries that endorsed that longer document we just looked at. Interestingly, the UK didn't sign it, and perhaps we'll have I'll have time to come back to that. It repeats most of the points in that longer UN draft declaration, but it's more explicit and clear about some things, and it should put to rest any idea that these governments have Palestinian rights or interests at heart. So let's just look at a little bit from this statement. It says, we foreign ministers of those various countries I named condemn the heinous and anti-Semitic terrorist attack of October 7th, 2023. Demand an immediate ceasefire, the immediate and unconditional release of all hostages of Hamas, including the remains, as well as ensuring unhindered humanitarian access. Now, let me comment on that. This statement condemns only the Palestinian resistance operation of October 7th, 2023, even declaring it anti-Semitic. I mean, this is just a wholesale regurgitation of the worst Israeli propaganda. This is like calling Irish resistance to British colonialism and savagery, Anglophobia or anti-Scottishism. Anti-Protestantism, which is indeed what the British claimed for many centuries. So it's shocking to me in particular that Ireland should sign this. And of course, there is no condemnation of Israel in this statement and no mention of genocide. Let me read on a little bit. These same foreign ministers, quote, reiterate our unwavering commitment to the vision of the two-state solution, where two democratic states, Israel and Palestine, live side by side in peace, within secure and recognized borders. And then they stress the importance of unifying the Gaza Strip with the West Bank under the Palestinian Authority. So here, they're declaring their commitment to the continued existence of the entity that is perpetrating genocide under the guise of a two-state solution, in which a non-sovereign Palestinian state will be ruled over by the Vichy-style a collaborator regime currently headed by Mahmoud Abbas. They all know when they wrote this statement that the Palestinian Authority works with the occupation. So how can this be about ending occupation if what you want to do is put in charge an entity that collaborates with the occupation? And now here they say a little bit more, I'll read from this, that they express grave concern over the high number of civilian casualties and humanitarian situation in Gaza. Now, listen to that passive language again, just like Keir Starmer. Having explicitly condemned the resistance and only the resistance, they only express vague concern over the mass killing of Palestinians in Gaza and the what they call the humanitarian situation, without mentioning who caused it, no mention of Israel. And then they go on and say, and this really re-emphasizes what we see in that longer UN document, they say that they quote, "We welcome the commitments made by the president of the Palestinian Authority, where he condemns the October 7th terrorist attacks, calls for the liberation of hostages and disarmament of Hamas, commits to terminate the prisoner payment system, commits to schooling reform, commits to call for elections within a year to trigger generational renewal, and accepts the principle of a demilitarized Palestinian state." So there you have it. No resistance, no self-defense, and then a state that is completely naked and defenseless in front of Israel. Then they get to talking about recognition, and they point out how a number of countries have already recognized Palestine or plan to. And they say that they urge other countries to consider doing the same. And they say, and I think this is the key point here, that they urge countries who have not done so yet to establish normal relations with Israel and to express their willingness to enter into discussions on the regional integration of the state of Israel. So they use their recognition of a non-existent Palestinian state that they're doing absolutely nothing to actually bring into existence as a cover for their real agenda, obtaining full recognition for Israel now, normalization now, and regional integration soon, while it's in the midst of perpetrating a Holocaust. This is about rewarding Israel during its genocide. And finally, they expressed their determination, quote, "to work on an architecture for the day after in Gaza, which guarantees the reconstruction of Gaza, the disarmament of Hamas, and its exclusion from the Palestinian governance." So they mention the disarmament of Hamas repeatedly in this document. And they use this Israeli terminology of the day after. And then this emphasizes, of course, that the elimination of Palestinian resistance is the goal, and deciding for Palestinians who will rule them. Again, no mention of disarming Israel or bringing its war crimes fugitive indicted leaders to justice. And then let's just look at the words of the French foreign minister, Jean-Noël Barrot, in his speech opening the UN conference. Of course, remember that France and Saudi Arabia are the co-conveners. And why France is recognizing a Palestinian state. So Barrot says, "France is prepared to fully recognize the state of Palestine and will do so in September. This recognition, a major decision by France, expresses a refusal and also contains a call, refusing to see the side of war standing victorious over that of peace, refusing to acquiesce to Hamas, which has always disputed Israel's right to exist and which has always fought the two-state solution for that reason. But Palestine is not and will never be Hamas. Recognizing a state of Palestine today means standing with the Palestinians who have chosen nonviolence, who have renounced terrorism, and are prepared to recognize Israel." So you can see that central to French concerns is the recognition of the genocidal state of Israel, securing it, and elevating Palestinians willing to surrender to Israel and collaborate with it. This is not about self-determination or independence for Palestinians. And finally, I want to recall that all this is happening at the UN General Assembly, which last September adopted a resolution endorsing an advisory opinion of the International Court of Justice. That decision came out last July on the legal consequences arising from Israel's policies and practices in the occupied territory. Now, that ICJ decision was celebrated at the time as historic because for the first time it declared Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, including East Jerusalem, to be illegal in and of itself. And it went even further because it said that all UN member states have an obligation to do everything in their power to bring Israel's occupation to an end as quickly as possible. And effectively, the ICJ called for and endorsed sanctions on Israel. In line with this, the UN passed a resolution, the UN General Assembly passed a resolution last September, which, quote, demands that Israel brings an end without delay. Let me read that again. Demands that Israel brings to an end without delay its unlawful presence in the occupied Palestinian territory, which constitutes a wrongful act of a continuing character entailing its international responsibility, and do so no later than 12 months from the adoption of this present resolution. So September 2024, the UN General Assembly overwhelmingly voted that Israel had 12 months to end its occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, which means that there's 1 month left to that deadline, basically. Instead, what France, Saudi Arabia, the Palestinian Authority, all those Arab states, and their other collaborators are doing is trying to revive an endless peace process in which the Palestinian people and their resistance are the wrongdoers, the aggressors, and the Israelis are the victims, and it is up to the Palestinians to disarm and jump through endless hoops, which, if they are lucky, will end in them being allowed to live under Israeli apartheid forever, which will be given the name of a state. So this is rewarding Israel's genocide and assuring it that no matter what it does, this so-called international community will never hold it accountable and will always blame the Palestinians for their own plight and exonerate Israel. And just in closing, I want to share some other reactions to this. One from our friend, the human rights lawyer, Craig Mukhaibar. And this was his excoriating assessment of this. He said, some states gathered at the UN in New York are trying to reanimate the stinking corpse of the Oslo process and the so-called two-state solution. Their goal is not Palestinian liberation, but rather to preserve the genocidal apartheid regime of Israel and its official racist ideology of Zionism. In return, they offer the possibility of a Palestinian Bantustan somewhere down the road. This approach can only extend Palestinian suffering, ensure further conflict, buttress Israeli impunity, and distract attention and effort from addressing the true root causes. It has failed. It will continue to fail. As with apartheid in South Africa, the Israeli regime must be isolated, defeated, dismantled and replaced with a democratic secular state with equal rights for all from the river to the sea. I couldn't agree more with that assessment by Craig Mukhaibar. And here is what Zara Sultana, a British Member of Parliament, said. Now, Sultana was until recently a member of the Labour Party, but left the Labour Party to join a new party being formed by Jeremy Corbyn. And this is what she said in response to British Foreign Minister David Lammy's announcement about the planned recognition of the Palestinian state by Britain. And she says, this is a PR stunt that lets Israel's genocide continue. Meanwhile, David Lammy won't expel the Israeli ambassador, end all trade, implement a full arms embargo, stop surveillance flights or UK training of Israeli soldiers. Empty gestures fool no one. He belongs in The Hague. And again, I think that that is absolutely right. Why are they at the UN talking about a so-called two-state solution instead of talking about sanctions, instead of holding Israel accountable for failing to meet that UN set deadline to end its occupation within 12 months? And above all, why aren't they doing everything in their power, as they're obliged to do under the 1948 Genocide Convention, to end this genocide. Not one of these countries has imposed an arms embargo, a trade embargo, diplomatic sanctions on Israel. As we've discussed in recent episodes, the European Union has imposed 18 sanctions packages on Russia and has not imposed a single sanction on Israel. So my appeal to people watching and listening to this is don't be fooled. Don't be distracted. These governments do not have the rights or interests or lives of Palestinians at heart. They can hear your protests. They can hear your anguish and outrage, and they are trying to distract you with this, to pose as champions of Palestinian statehood, when what they're trying to achieve is Israel's goals under the fake guise of a peace process. It has to be exposed as such. Stay on message. This genocide has to end, and they have an obligation to take immediate, practical, active steps to prevent and punish Israel from carrying out this genocide. Thanks, Nora.
Thank you so much, Ali, for breaking that down, for reading these just despicable racist pro-genocide proposals, guised in the language of diplomacy and international morals and human rights. But you're right. This is a gift to Israel on a silver platter.
Yeah, Israel could have written that declaration, and Israel's
probably
tactic,
did.
Don't be fooled. Be fooled by Israel's opposition to this.
Right.
Israel is screaming bloody murder. Oh, yeah. Don't recognize a Palestinian state. Don't recognize a Palestinian state. But that draft document, endorsed by, again, all those Europeans, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Jordan, the Arab League, Egypt, etc., etc., that document contains every single Israeli agenda point, including annexation of West Bank land, because you heard Antonio Guterres there saying, I'm not sure we played it in that clip, but in the longer speech that he gave, he talks about a Palestinian state based on the 1967 borders.
Right.
Not on the 1967 borders. So they're not talking about full withdrawal from even the West Bank and Gaza. I always say that's like when you watch a cheesy TV movie and they say it's based on a true story, which means that it may have a very passing relationship to reality, but it's just all fiction. So when they say based on the 1967 borders, it doesn't mean anything.
No.
So this is all a disgusting deception. Antonio Guterres is also trying to assert that the so-called two-state solution is the only solution. Why? Because there is an alternative. The alternative is ending Israeli apartheid, abolishing this genocidal regime, just as the apartheid regime in South Africa was abolished, just as Nazi Germany was abolished. That's the right thing to do here. This regime should come to an end so that all the people in the land who want to live as equals can do so. And those who stick to this murderous Zionist ideology need to go through a process of de-Zionization. We should not indulge their racist fantasies anymore, and we should have no tolerance for this. And I'll just say a last thing here. If you think back a few weeks ago to when we spoke with Craig Mukhaibar about the Sarajevo declaration and the Sarajevo tribunal, how firm that was on confronting this wishy-washy two-state language, and we have to be the same.
That's right. And always centering the Palestinian right of return in trying to imagine, what they call the day after. The day after doesn't mean Israel finally gets what it wants and a dissolution of Palestinians' inalienable right to return to their homes. That's not what the day after is. And we have to be, as you said, we have to be very firm in continuing to focus on Israel's responsibility, the so-called international community's responsibility and obligations under international law to stop this and stop Israel and not reward it with its fantasies of complete, you know, complete settler colonial domination of Palestine. Thank you for that, Ali. Let's bring John on for the resistance report. Hey, John.
Hear, hear to that, Ali.
Yeah.
Thanks, John.
Canada wants a Zionist Palestinian state.
Yeah. Yeah. A demilitarized and unarmed Palestinian state.
Yeah.
I'm here to tell you the Qassam brigades are not disarming.
Yeah, I can't remember if we mentioned that on a previous show, but John, what you're referring to there is that Mark Carney, the Canadian Prime Minister, actually used those words. He said he wanted to see a Zionist Palestinian state. He said that a few weeks ago.
He's repeated it.
That's the vision.
Yeah.
He's
repeated it.
That's so bold.
What a time to be alive.
Yeah. All right. Well, John, there has been some operations this week, and we want to ask you at the very end about some current news that came that missed the deadline for your resistance report roundup. But let's take it away, and then we'll come back.
All right, let's do it. All right, so you are watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada. I am John Elmer. This is the resistance report for day 664 of this criminal madness. I am reporting this on the 31st of July. And as ever, everything you're going to see this week has been published by the Resistance since you last saw me. And also, as always, let's start with the maps. We've been using these United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs maps, which do not show Israeli control in Gaza. They show what are shoot-to-kill zones and evacuation zones in Gaza. And we have been counting this number up every week as we come on. And now we're up to 88% in shoot to kill zones. And you can see the three ghettos that are forming pretty clearly here. In the south, you see Al-Mawasi on the coast at the bottom of that map from Khan Yunis. In the middle camps, Deir al-Bala is another zone, and then that's Gaza City that is being encroached upon with evacuation orders, but not Israeli control. And I always want to underscore that this is not about Israeli control. It's about where the shoot to kill zones are, and it's where the population is not anymore in all those purple areas. And that is where the resistance is fighting the Israelis every single day. Satellite imagery over the last few weeks has shown very little Israeli military advance. I think that's notable. We were talking on this program about the hundreds of operations in Khan Yunis against the Israeli military, which was the focus of Israel's Gideon's Chariots operation that began in May. And there was a couple of several devastating operations that have led to troops being really zipped into their armored vehicles. And the forward advance is very little from the Israeli military, and Israeli military bloggers themselves have pointed this out, how there's very little action. The Israeli military, we're hearing that from them as well through their leaks, which are happening. We know that June was the deadliest month for the Israeli military in the past year, and July has matched June in that total. The Israeli Ministry of Defense's rehab department this week talked about 18,500 wounded soldiers in the war, which makes sense because throughout the war, they have been saying that there's at least 1,000 Israeli soldiers wounded every month of the battle. There's been, of course, periods of ceasefire in there. So 1,850 seems consistent with what they're releasing as the casualty counts. But again, on the week-to-week basis, month-to-month basis, we don't see any casualty counts. Those are hidden from us, from the public. And there's been, I talked about it last week, increasing volume within the Israeli press and military analysts. This week, Nahum Barnia, who's essentially the dean of the Israeli press corps. He wrote in Yedioth Ahronot that the failure of the military in campaign in Gaza should serve as a warning to Israeli army leaders. So he's a significant voice in the Israeli press. The New York Times had a headline this week, "Total Failure, Israel's Return to War Heaped Ruin on Gaza and Did Little for Israelis." And they quote Michael Milstein, who is an Amman Israeli military intelligence officer. And he said, "I have used these words, total failure. We are no closer to achieving our main goal to erase the military and governmental capacities of Hamas. And Hamas has not become more flexible in the ceasefire talks. We find ourselves right now in a total disaster." Now, this is all consistent with what you've heard on the Resistance Report for the last coming up on 2 years now. Israel has not achieved its goals. They are well articulated. They are return the captives through violence. That has failed. Destroy the Qassam brigades. That has clearly failed. Destroy the government. We see the municipal and local government functioning and to make Gaza no longer a threat, which I think is the least likely outcome of this war, with 50% of the population kids, witnessing what we have all witnessed for the last 2 years. Resistance is not going to die out based on this genocide. It'll only increase. Opposition leader Yair Lapid said that based on the intelligence and operational information that he has received due to his position, so he's talking about classified briefings that he gets, he says, the government has failed in the war. This is not a victory. It's a total disaster. And also, Yoav Zetun of Yedioth Ahronot wrote this week that more and more soldiers are reporting that officers are threatening them, including through their parents, if they complain about the distress and extreme workload in the media. Company and battalion commanders demand that their soldiers stay silent, handling issues only within the unit. On the other hand, the officers are required to meet mission demands no matter what. And those above them are not reflecting to the public and parents what is happening to the soldiers. And of course, we've seen the manpower shortages is a major story in Israel, and the 18,500 casualties, people taken off the battlefield, 1,000, they've admitted to upwards of 1,000 killed. As well, and they're not replacing those soldiers at the moment. If we take a look at this next map, you can see one of Israel's responses to this, to their campaign of starvation, has not worked in defeating the resistance or making the Palestinians surrender. It's, of course, worked very well in killing children and the weakest members of society who are in the most in need of nutrition, wounded people who are coming into the hospitals malnourished and unable to heal properly. That works. It works for genocide, but it hasn't got the Palestinians to surrender. And that's why there's a lot of talk in the media about what Ali just addressed as well. This next map, let's take a look at the zoom in on the south, because we're going to focus. Rafah is completely destroyed. Khan Yunis is the target, essentially, of this phase of the Israeli operation that has been a failure. And if we look at the next map, you can see this is how far Abasan al-Kabira is, where the operation that I'm going to show you today was. It's also where many of the spectacular, notable operations that the Israelis know about and were upset about in their media because of the videos that were published of their defeats in that area. That's in Abasan al-Kabira on the east. It's just a few hundred meters from the buffer zone. So when we're talking about Israeli control, this is a Haaretz map, and that red is denotes destruction, not operational control. But when you're talking about operational control over these areas, Abasan al-Kabira is in the far east, right on the border, and the Israelis don't have operational control over that area, as we are going to see coming up in these videos. I'm going to just start before we go to the first video and just remind you that on February 20th, 2024, day 127, Army Radio says, commander of the 98th Division, Brigadier General Dan Goldfuss, who commands the fighting in Khan Yunis, the first battle of Khan Yunis, said this evening, quote, "We dismantled Hamas in Khan Yunis. We destroyed it underground and on land." So that was 537 days ago. It was as ridiculous at that point as it is today. But these operations today are going to show you that that is how absurd those statements of operational control have been throughout the war, which shows that Israel doesn't have a grasp on the battlefield, or they're just straight up lying to their population, probably both. And I just want to give you the field report for this operation before we watch it, because again, these field reports from Qassam are specifically very particularly accurate. Qassam field report on the 26th of July: during a complex ambush, Al-Qassam fighters targeted two Zionist personnel carriers with two guerrilla action devices placed inside their cockpits, leading to the burning of the carriers and their crews. After that, our fighters targeted a third Zionist personnel carrier with a Yassin 105 in the Abbasan al-Kabira area east of Khan Yunis and south of the Gaza Strip. Our fighters observed a military excavator burying the burning carriers to extinguish the fires as helicopters land for the evacuation. So that's the field report that comes out before anyone has seen any video. Let's look at that video now, number six. We're going to see, again, showing the fighters doing their troop leading procedures. They're going over the operation. You can see the drone footage on the tablet. You can see the closed line that they use to talk to the spotters. The commander here is saying that our brothers in the surveillance unit assured us that there's three troop carriers in this position. He's pointing to them. They're 30 to 40 meters away from the tunnel entrance. Now we see the spotters' position, seeing those a place where there's a concentration of armored vehicles. Now we see two fighters emerging from the tunnel. You can see them both getting their bearings, pointing and picking their targets based on their operational briefing. You can see the two guerrilla action devices there. Now we're looking at the fighter running towards the Namur troop carrier. And this is higher than the Puma that we saw, armored personnel carrier before, where the fighter just climbed up on top of it easily. This one you have to hike up. It's about 10 feet tall. So he's hiking up on top of it, pulls the detonator, drops it into the hatch, drops back down and heads back to the tunnel. You can see right there as he's running back, you can see it detonate on the way back to returning to his base safely. That's what I'm saying about being zipped in. These soldiers are inside their armored vehicles. And then here comes, like from the field report, there's the excavator burying the burning vehicle in with sand to put out the fire. Now, it's unclear if they've removed the casualties from this, because we know from the last operation where we saw this tactic be used, the Israelis allowed the carrier to burn and they towed it back to Israel with the soldiers inside burning and made for recognition of their bodies extremely difficult, as Army Radio reported. There's two killed reported by the Israelis on this, and multiple casualties in this operation. I'm going to just show you now a couple parts of this operation. So this is the beginning that I was talking about. You can see on the left, you see the phone, the closed line that the resistance has been using throughout this battle. The Israelis are not in on this line. This line connects to the tunnels, keeps the fighters underground and below ground connected, keeps the spotters connected. The commander is saying that this information came from the spotter. You can see the diagram in the middle there that shows the targets. You could see the Qassam Brigade's internal memos on the right-hand side there showing command and control. And you see a tablet from drone footage that the resistance has used to execute this operation. So again, like Abu Ubaida said last week, these are high-level operations that are carried out. They're intelligence, reconnaissance, and surveillance-based operations. And that is why they're successful. They're not the product of the failures of Israeli military. These are the product of the success of the resistance preparation. So that is that first. You can also see in the top there, the BARC, that's the guerrilla action device. We saw that guerrilla action device last week in the videos from Jabalia, and seeing it again in Khan Yunis is interesting. This looks like a device that they're manufacturing currently, presumably they are filled with unexploded ordnance, and this is going to be a tool that we see the resistance using in the days ahead. If we go to the next one, you can see the still of the bark there, the guerrilla action device. Both fighters that come out of the tunnel, they both have one in their hands. One fighter goes one direction, one fighter goes the other direction, and only one of them has a camera on their head, but there's two parts to this operation. So it's interesting to note this new new use of this weapon that looks like a miniature Shawad, easier to carry, guerrilla action device, easier for the commando to navigate with rather than the heavier Shawad. And because the spotters told them that the hatch is open on the Namur troop carrier, that is what the surveillance is telling them. So they're using this device to attack that position, knowing that the hatch is open. So I think that's just a detail that I wanted to point out. The next one you could see, this is them coming out of the tunnel, number 9. You can see the two coming out. You see the two fingers there pointing because the fighters are coming up from underground and getting their bearings, and they're both figuring out their targets based on the troop leading procedure that they got from their commander. So I thought that was an interesting note. And then this next one is, this came from the Israeli military through the Times of Israel, but you can see it says, according to the initial IDF probe, the soldiers were inside a Namur armored personnel carrier that was hit by an explosive device during operations in Khan Yunis. The military says is continuing to investigate how the bomb was detonated against the APC. And if we look at this next frame, you can see how the bomb was detonated against the APC. The Israelis clearly have no clue what's going on, even after these operations are happening. You can see him pulling the detonator there and popping it in through the hatch. And you can see the way that the detonator works. There's two detonator pins for a left-handed or a right-handed person, one on the top, one on the side. He goes with it for his left hand here and misses, so then he switches to his right hand. Again, these are effective weapons properly designed to be used in this moment where you can't be stumbling around looking for your detonator. He pulls the pin, and then he's got about 6 seconds before the detonation. The detonation mechanism triggers. He gets 6 seconds before it explodes. So that just remarkable operation in Abasan al-Kabira. Just as we were coming on air, Army Radio reported on leaked drone footage. Again, we're seeing leaked drone footage from the Israelis. I think what we're seeing is pressure inside the Israeli military to try to end this, genocidal war. That they don't want to be a part of anymore, that they're getting killed, that they're working too hard, like I said before. They're not allowed to speak honestly and openly. Their commanders are disciplining them. So Army Radio showed this drone footage of a large squad, 12 fighters with Yassins, emerging from a tunnel earlier this week in Khan Yunis and laying in ambush on an earthen embankment near a logistics route that IDF forces have been taking. So this is the capture operations that I also talked about last week on the show, and Abu Obeida said would be the focus of the resistance, and now we're seeing it from the Israeli side. Army Radio says IDF forces from the Golani's 13th Battalion identified the fighters using a drone, and when the Qassam fighters saw the drone, they retreated back into the tunnel to return to their base safely. It's not a suicide mission. They saw the mission wasn't going to be successful because of the drone, and they tactically withdrew for another day. So that's an interesting detail as well. And also Army Radio, just throw this in at the bottom, what the Army Radio correspondent says is significant about this event. He says, it's an event that shows the resistance are currently operating not only in small unorganized squads of 2 to 3, but large, well-armed squads familiar with the terrain. They arrived in a planned point, They arrived in a planned manner at the point, accompanied by remote drone operators, because Qassam had drones on this as well, and had a retreat route in case the plan went wrong. So just Army Radio admiring the resistance carrying out these operations effectively, something that we've been watching on this program for 664 days now. Let's move to the middle camps, number 12. Israel Quds carried out an operation in the middle camps. This invasion of the middle camps that we saw last week was very short. The Israelis went in for, was measured in hours in the middle camps. So this operation happened at that time. They didn't get the video out, but Qassam did last week, and we saw three Yassin operations. Two of them were tunnel-borne operations that met the Israelis immediately when they invaded the middle camps. So the middle camps brigade is ready in their fighting positions, waiting for 21 months. The Israelis come across and they're hit right away. This is Sir Al-Quds operation from that day as well. And this is the surveillance footage of the detonation of that device. Sir Al-Quds is using pressure plate detonators. I'll show you that in the upcoming videos. But let's take a look at the north of Gaza, where there's also fighting. This is the same map that we showed you. The fighting has been east of Salah ad-Din Road, and that is the focus, Zaytun, Shajaiya, Tufa, and the eastern side of Jabalia City. They have not been fighting in Jabalia camp in this round. If we look at the next map, you can see that the Israelis had three divisions in this area, but they pulled out the 98th Division. Their commando brigade has been pulled out of Gaza, so there's now just the two in the north. And I just wanted to bring you this map because it more accurately shows where you might say the Israelis believe they have control over. It's a much, much smaller area than they're saying in their statements that say 75% of Gaza is under their control. It's simply not true. In the bottom right of that map is Beit Hanun, and for the fifth time, in this war, the Israelis have said that they have destroyed the Beit Hanun battalion. They said that there's one more week and they should be finished off, which is, you know, something that we have heard many times before in all of these areas, trying to claim victory in a war that they're not achieving their objectives in. If we look at number 15, this is another Saraya Al-Quds operation. You can see them there with their IED, presumably filled again with unexploded ordnance. It said Saraya Al-Quds on the IED, and this is the pressure plate detonators. And this is useful at this point in the war because of the shoot-to-kill zones cover so much territory in Gaza that anyone moving in that area is shot, killed, bombed. They're not shot, they're bombed. And so they plant these pressure plate detonators, and when the tank, what you're seeing here, there's a tank rolling over them, it trips them. So the fighters don't have to be in the position to press the detonator for when the Israelis then attack and bomb everything in the area, so the fighters can return to their base safely. And returning to their base safely has been a core part of the ability of the resistance to continue fighting this long. Now we'll take a look. We're going to move further north to Jabalia, number 16. This video, I showed you this video on day 615. This was leaked video by the Israelis. You could see a Qassam fighter putting the Shawad at the back door of a Merkava tank and blowing it up. I zoomed it in for you so you can see that a little bit closer. People may remember when I showed this. This was leaked by the Israelis, but there was no operation or even a field report from Qassam that showed us what we were looking at from the ground, but they have done that this week, and they have published those videos. And publishing videos late or like weeks after the operation took place is something that we see. Operational security sometimes makes it so that the resistance doesn't want to release the videos, doesn't want to communicate through their channels. Maybe they think they don't want to risk the channel being compromised, and so they wait. We saw that in Shajaiya last year during the three-week operation in Shajaiya, and Qassam released all the videos afterwards. We even saw it in the first Khan Yunis battle last December to April, that the Khan Yunis brigade wasn't immediately releasing videos because of operational reasons. And that's what we're seeing here in these next videos. These are operations by the Qassam brigades that were executed in June and July. So here's that operation that we saw leaked from the Israelis. You see the fighter here attaching the detonator pin that we saw on the Bark guerrilla action device. This is it being done on the Shawad. He's putting the detonator into the top there, and he's going to to do what we just saw on the Israeli video. But now we're seeing that same video from the inside, and they have used, Qassam has used the cut from the Israelis to show that. But we saw him inside that building, and this is now the second time we've seen Qassam release footage that had previously been shown by leaked Israeli drone footage. So that is notable. And then the leak today that I just reported on is another notable one. So we're getting these leaks from the Israelis more regularly, although we have gotten them all through the war. And many of the leaks, they don't make the Israeli military look good. They often are seen in the Palestinian community as heroic operations that the Israelis are showing, or they're the ones where the Israelis are getting shot inside buildings and are falling down stairs, and it's not clear what the Israelis think they're getting out of these this footage. This operation is a historic operation that people will talk about for a long time to come. So what they think they're getting out of releasing it is not at all clear. But that's the operation from Qassam's side. Number 18 is another Shawath from the rubble operation. You can see the fighters in the rubble here. You're going to see the tank straight ahead, and the fighters got the Shawath there. You get the green triangle for the Shawath, the red for the tank. And these operations that you're going to see, these next few, so he's setting up the Shawath. He can't get closer because of all of the wreckage in the way, but he pulls the pin. He gets 6 seconds, gets back down underground underneath the demolition. There you see the Shawath detonate. And this is interesting. We'll just look at it one more time, because the reason why this operation can take place is because of this stage of the war, Israel's using excavators to drop these houses. So they're going one by one through the houses and pulling them down. They're not bombing them into a pile of rubble. They're pulling them down and leaving these pockets that we're watching the resistance use to attack Israeli vehicles from the pockets. So just adaptations throughout the war that we've seen are just notable. So you see him go down into an area there that would be blown up if the Israelis used aerial bombs to hit that target. And you're going to see that a couple other times. Number 19. We have a Yassin strike against a Merkava tank. This was July 16th, according to Qassam. You can see the tank there with its turret turned. And you're going to see the Archer hit a direct hit on this tank as usual. The Yassin is a very accurate weapon from the distance that the fighters use it for. You can clearly see that is a direct hit. You're going to see a direct hit in the next footage as well. But again, destruction everywhere. And the resistance is, these are not controlled areas. When your tanks are getting blown up, you do not have operational control over the area, because operational control would mean that your tank can roll through there and execute the task that they're tasked with, and that's not what's happening when they're hit with these Yassin strikes. So again, you see the tank moving there, and the Archer is in the next window from the cameraman. You can see the Yassin overpressure blows the camera, which we have seen all through the war. The next one that you see here is a Yassin strike against a Namer. This is again also in earlier in July, and you can see the fighter with his Yassin here. And again, what I was talking about, you see it's created, the excavators have created these pockets in the rubble, and the resistance is using these pockets. That's a Namur troop carrier, so you could have a dozen people in there depending on the formation. But you're going to see on the left side, the Yassin will come through there and hit on the left side of your screen. You can see another direct hit by these anti-tank weapons that were created by the Qassam brigades, and they still have enough of these to carry out the battle 664 days later. Number 21 is another tactical use of drones. So this is a Qassam drone being used here to track an engineering unit. And then because they have drone footage, they can see where the armored vehicles are. They know they have a little bit of time to come out in the street and bury this IED. And of course, they can bury it in the street because the Israelis have torn everything up and made them easy to bury and easy to hide that they're buried. And there you're seeing the detonation from a surveillance camera. I think it's a surveillance camera, although this move here that you'll see here, there, that jerk does sound, that seems like a drone footage, that camera jerk there. Okay, we can go to number 22. This is an excavator that's doing what I've been talking about, pushing the houses down. And this excavator dropped the house on top of the excavator arm. So now the fighters are using the pocket that was created, and the a radia there, that's the anti-personnel or against a light vehicle like this excavator is, that is now stuck in the rubble. You can see its bucket there stuck under the building, and it's blown up. So they're down an excavator on that operation. Again, that was in early July, and these are all operations from Jabalia, all released by Qassam. And number 23 is the footage that was also, this was released in June by the Israelis, and Qassam is showing us this again, just their D9 destroyed bulldozer. You can clearly see it was hit there on the side, clearly see it was hit by a Yassin, and it's being dragged by two other D9 bulldozers. And last week, or maybe 2 weeks ago on the show, I showed you how the D9s are being unloaded from the U.S. The U.S. is resupplying them with these vehicles. But it's just a pathetic view of the drag, literally dragging these destroyed things through the genocidal landscape that they have created here. And just on a final note, a poster by Qassam published this week, showing a fighter with a Yassin, and that tank is from Beit Hanun. That was the one that was split in Beit Hanun. The tank had its turret tossed. And then that's the quote from Abu Ubaidah that I read you last week. The resistance in Gaza is the greatest military school in contemporary history for a people's resistance against their occupier, as I think those videos have more than shown. So that is the resistance report for day 664 of this war.
So much that happened this week, John. Thank you for that. And yeah, I mean, I was, you know, right before we went on air, we were talking about that statement by Israeli Army Radio from just a few hours ago, where they were like, I think you said impressed or something, but they were like, oh my God, we had no idea that Qassam was acting like a real military, you know, with like planning and operations.
Well, they have to say that because they've been lying for months to say, oh no, they're just guerrillas running around Gaza in twos and threes. They're not organized. And it's just, so when they do that and then they see a video like that, they kind of have to say like, oh, they're actually operating in this effective way. And to see the withdrawal of those forces, I'll break that video down next week when we have some time. But to see the forces withdraw is just a remarkable, it's a remarkable statement about the resistance in this time of starvation and devastation in Gaza, that the fighters' priority is executing operations, effective operations. And if the operation is not there, they're willing to tactically retreat and execute it at another time so that their fighters live. And I think that is, that's really part of the story here that we've been watching for 664 days. I can't believe it when we say it.
And the other thing that I thought was, notable is, you know, the story that that I talked about in the news report at the top of the show, where these 10 children, these you know, young teenage boys, were kidnapped a month ago, trying to retrieve, you know, an aid box at these U.S. American Israeli GHF sites. They were kidnapped and tortured and interrogated for a month by the Israelis, who were trying to extract any information they had about the fighters. And, you know, these boys had none, obviously. But it kind of, you know, it's a very significant detail that I think gets kind of passed over, where Israel doesn't have the intel that it would like to brag that it does about the operations of the Palestinian resistance. And they're, you know, they're torturing children to try and extract
doctors.
Doctors, exactly. Yeah. Right.
I know.
It's
upsetting because it's that we haven't ever seen fighters being captured. All we have seen is civilians who don't have anything to do with anything except working in hospitals, going to pick up aid for their families who are starving. You know, you see people, elderly people being arrested. We've seen thousands of people in Gaza just taken. They got taken from shelters. You know, the fighters are not sitting in the UN shelters. When you're going into a UN shelter, you're taking hostage civilians. And it's just, you know, it's one of the hardest parts about this whole thing is watching that military criminality. It's shameful military behavior. And it's just on a enormous scale.
Yeah.
I mean, you would, as a proper military, you would discipline your soldiers for capturing random people who don't have anything to do with anything and wasting the resources of your fighting force. But for Israel, that's the only thing they can do. Massacre civilians, take people hostage, and they don't have the resistance. And they offer $5 million. Those kids, they were offered $5 million each if they just told Benjamin Netanyahu where the captives were. And in a place where everybody's being literally starved to death, nobody has given any information about any captive anywhere in Gaza in 664 days. It's a tribute to the Palestinians. The resistance is fighting, but the population is fighting. And that was what Abu Obeida underscored multiple times in his message last week. It was not simply a military message. It was a message of the way that the entire society is part of this national liberation struggle. And we saw it from Rueda earlier. We saw it from Dunya last week, the way that everyday people, teachers, students, doctors are trying. I mean, doctors are giving blood in the hospitals. It's just, I wish we had time to tell all of these stories all the time, because it's history will reflect very well on the steadfastness of the Palestinians in Gaza during this Holocaust, as Ali said.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that again. Ali and Asa, did you have any, you know, points that you wanted to make about the resistance report or kind of how it dovetails? And, you know, I mean, there's also this whole notion of how, you know, this assumption, this very racist colonial assumption that Hamas is just going to voluntarily disarm, and then achieve some sort of like normalization state that's run by the traitors and the West itself. I mean, it's just so, if it wasn't so tragic, it'd be hilarious. But, you know, they think that Hamas is going to surrender now.
Yeah, Hamas is not going to disarm. Like, you know, as John said, it's not even on the table. You know, it's not even really being discussed. What is being discussed is Hamas voluntarily handing over the government. But, you know, it's always been Hamas's reason for existence is resistance. You know, it's literally called the Islamic Resistance Movement. That's what Hamas means. So it's reason. It's, you know, foundational reason is to resist Israel. It's not to govern, you know, and it was during the whole Oslo process, it was opposed to it because it saw it as a capitulation and they were opposed to the whole mechanism of the Palestinian Authority. They later shifted their position, of course, and were elected to the leadership of the Palestinian Authority. But, you know, I think it's very clear for everybody to see, for for all Palestinians to see that it's a zero-sum game. You know, you can surrender, but you will still be annihilated. So there's no reason for them to surrender.
And you're right about that, Asa, but Hamas has always said, including in its May 17th, sort of its renewed charter, that resistance isn't an end in itself, and it was always willing to give up the armed struggle as part of a political process that achieved Palestinian rights. They've said that. But what is being proposed, what I discussed, isn't to lead to Palestinian rights. It's disarmament in order to assure that there are no Palestinian rights, right, to ensure continued Israeli domination and subjugation. So why would a resistance organization give up its weapons in that context? And the what's the leverage here? When you have all those governments that are shirking, I want to find a stronger word than shirking, flagrantly neglecting their responsibility to hold Israel accountable, to end the occupation, to stop the genocide, and they say Hamas must disarm. Well, what's the leverage for that? It's the same leverage Israel has, which is to starve the civilian population. There's no other leverage, because if they could get Hamas to disarm in any other way, the Israelis would have done it, right? They've been telling us for 21 months that that's their goal. They're going to disarm Hamas and they're going to destroy Hamas militarily. If they could, they would have done it. If Keir Starmer could have done it with the participation of the Royal Air Force, he would have done it. So they have no leverage with Hamas except two ways. One is to respect and fulfill Palestinian rights. That's not on the agenda of the West and the Arab regimes. Or alternatively, to continue to try to starve and murder the Palestinian civilian population until the resistance submits. And that formula is not going to lead them where they want at all.
And Hamas has got the historical precedent of the PLO to look at as well. And there's no way they're going to be ignoring that. You know,
they have the historical present of the PLO, not just the precedent. Look at the West Bank.
Yeah.
We're going to do more reporting about the West Bank, but look at the West Bank. The Israelis are destroying the West Bank, murdering people in the West, up and down the West Bank. So surrender doesn't work. The choices Israel gives you are surrender or we'll kill you. That's choice A. Or choice B, surrender and we'll kill you. Yeah. That's what they're doing in Lebanon. Yeah. You know, there's supposedly a ceasefire, and not surrender. By no means did the resistance in Lebanon surrender. But they did agree to a ceasefire. Has there been a ceasefire? The Syrians, the Al-Qaeda ISIS dictatorship installed by MI6 and the CIA in Damascus, has said, we have no hostility to Israel. We're ready to defend, to protect Israel from
any resistance. Yes, please take South Syria.
Take South Syria. Yeah. And Israel's still bombing Syria.
Yeah,
of course, you know, not only did the PLO, you know, there's two precedents, and there's two, and the second of those precedents is, like you said, Ali, is the ongoing present. The first, of course, in 1982 in Lebanon, when the PLO agreed to be deported and hand over its weapons effectively, certainly remove its weapons from Lebanon. And the result was notoriously the Sabra and Shatila massacre. The PLO agreed in the early 90s to transform itself into essentially a Palestinian Quisling entity at the behest of the Israeli occupation in the West Bank. And that's, you know, that's what we're seeing now ever since. I really appreciated your segment earlier, Ali, about this, because, you know, even the most progressive politicians in the West, they're, you know, certainly in Britain, they're most the furthest they can go, it seems, is to call for a so-called Palestinian state, but it's not really a Palestinian state. They're talking about the recognizing the Palestinian Authority, which is ultimately under the I've said in the past, it's called the Palestinian Authority, but it's not really Palestinian, and it has no authority. You know, it's Palestinian in the sense that it's run by Palestinians, but it's not run in the interest of Palestinians as a whole, only of a comprador class. It has no real authority, because all of its authority actually derives from the Israelis. So, you know, they're Quislings is what they are.
Indeed. Well, thanks for that. There's a couple of things that also came up this week, including a very well-known Israeli human rights group, two well-known Israeli human rights groups that finally declared that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. It took them 22 months. B'Tselem and Physicians for Human Rights Israel. Ali, break down why this is significant or not, and why you think it's taken them almost 2 years. What that's about.
Yeah, as you said, Nora, this week, two well-known Israeli human rights groups finally declared that Israel's committing genocide in Gaza, B'Tselem and Physicians for Human Rights. And in a new report published earlier this week, B'Tselem says, quote, "For nearly 2 years, Israel has been committing genocide in Gaza, acting in a systematic, deliberate way to destroy the Palestinian society there through mass killing, causing serious bodily and mental harm, and creating catastrophic conditions that prevent its continued existence in Gaza." And then they say this genocide must be stopped. And Physicians for Human Rights says, and it issued its own position paper, quote, "Today, Physicians for Human Rights Israel is releasing a position paper that documents this assault for what it is, a deliberate cumulative dismantling of Gaza's health system, and with it, its people's ability to survive. This amounts to genocide." So, I had a number of reactions to this. The first, I think, shared by many, is better late than never. I haven't had a chance yet to read these reports in detail. I like to read things really cover to cover, but there's only so many hours in the day. And I'm sure that based on the record of these organizations, these reports will contain useful information and analysis, which we should definitely draw on. I'm not saying we shouldn't do that, but really, what took them so long? I mean, yeah. UN experts and countless others, most importantly, Palestinians and Palestinian human rights groups, had warned of genocide since right after October 7th. You'll recall that first statement from a number of UN independent experts and hundreds of Holocaust scholars, international law experts, they were issuing statements around October 15th and 16th of 2023, warning about genocide. And then, of course, we know that the ICJ case put forward by South Africa came shortly after that, and the preliminary ruling was in January of 2024. So it's not as if this was a hard call to make. It's the easiest and most documented genocide in history, the easiest to recognize, I mean. So why didn't they speak out? I think they have to account for that, and I haven't seen that. And particularly Physicians for Human Rights Israel, I think, has even more accounting to do, because this group, which I had a lot of respect for previously, contributed to the genocide by using its credibility to spread atrocity propaganda about the non-existent, no evidence for them, October 7th mass rapes. And as I reported in May of 2024, Physicians for Human Rights did is that they published a report soon after October 7th, that is still being cited by proponents of the rape hoax, purporting to gather together information about it. But in spring of 2024, they walked that back, and they said it is becoming more apparent that the violence perpetrated against women, men, recognized that they had actually shared information that was disputed or unverifiable, and that the whole, that much of the information they had shared about the rapes was fake. Yeah. But they, and they said, we regret their inclusion in their position paper, the one that, claimed there were all these rapes. And they also claimed that a substantial portion of the information that is now available was not accessible when the document was originally drafted, the document alleging mass rapes. That is not true. We were able to debunk those stories very early on. And I don't think that Physicians for Human Rights ever really properly accounted for its role or repaired the damage. And they said back when they retracted much of their claims about mass rapes, quote, sexual violence and allegations of sexual violence must never be weaponized as tools of warfare or propaganda. That was too little, too late then. And again, it's too little, too late for them to be declaring genocide now. But that said, better late than never. For the, you know, for what these reports are worth, for the good information they include, use them. But I do quite resent that it often takes Israeli organizations to come out before people will start to believe what Palestinians have been telling them and documenting for years.
Yeah, and then just pretending the Palestinians weren't saying it all along. It's incredibly frustrating.
Why wasn't it big international headlines when Al-Haq or Al-Mizan or other Palestinian organizations came out and declared this to be a genocide right at the beginning? Why wasn't that in The Guardian and The New York Times and the BBC and Deutsche Welle and so on? Just totally absent.
These positions of these Israeli NGOs is very, I don't know if like a memo went out among Western media over the last week or something. But all of the front pages of the British newspapers, or most of them anyway, have all suddenly noticed that there's an engineered, or certainly that there's a mass starvation in Gaza, you know, and it's
damage control at this point.
They
want to, you know,
salvage. It's reputation saving because nobody, as we said, as I think I said before, nobody wants to be the last one to declare it's a genocide. But there's a problem with admitting that it's genocide too, especially for the Western governments or Western leaders, is you have to admit your complicity. You may actually be making a confession that opens you to criminal liability, because genocide is an internationally prosecutable crime. Any country can prosecute it. So if you're a government official who aided and abetted Israel, and now you admit that what you are aiding and abetting is a genocide, you could face prison for that in a world that worked according to how it's supposed to. But you never know. These people don't want to, you know, looking 5-10 years down the road, things might change and they may start getting arrested.
Yeah, and that's why Keir Starmer, the British Prime Minister, and David Lammy, his foreign minister, or certainly a large part of the reason, that's why they have not said that it's a genocide. There's certainly a large part of the reason, because they would be directly liable for their and enthusiastic involvement in the genocide.
Didn't Starmer actually say, there's that video of him speaking on LBC radio before he became prime minister, but after October 7th, when he was asked directly, does Israel have the right to cut off food, electricity, water to people in Gaza? And he said yes.
Yeah.
He said yes.
Yeah. You know, he tried to kind of say that he was only talking about Israel's quote unquote right to self-defense, but it's very clear on the video. He's asked in black and white terms, you know, Israel is cutting off water, electricity, food, fuel. Does Israel have a right to do that? And he said, I think it's very difficult, but I think that Israel does have that right. So, you know, it's very, very clear. It's very, very clear, you know, that they were actively involved. They have been actively involved and they're still actively involved. You know, the spy flights have been going over the British, the Royal Air Force spy flights have been going over Gaza continuously for the better part of 2 years. Although Matt Kinnard, the journalist Matt Kinnard, has done so much to expose this, the role of the British Air Force, did say this week that it looks like they may be coming to an end. again, you have to wonder if there's some kind of reputation management there. But of course, we do want those fights to end.
And should we actually watch that Starmer video? I just people to remember.
Do we have to?
Yeah, no, it's short. Let's watch it. It's a Tamara. I dropped it in the chat, and because remember when he talked about the in the clip I showed, he talked about the Gaza humanitarian, you know, a failure of humanitarian aid.
That's so disgusting.
Failure of humanitarian aid is disgusting. So I don't know. Maybe I'm throwing it Tamara too fast. She usually can. If we're unable to do it, it's okay. But I threw it at you. I put you on the spot there.
Very clear. Israel must have that, does have that right to defend herself. And Hamas bears responsibility.
A siege is appropriate? Cutting off power? Cutting off water? Sakir?
Well, I think that Israel does have that right. It is an ongoing situation. Obviously, everything should be done within international law, but I don't want to step away from the sort of core principles that Israel has a right to defend herself and Hamas bears responsibility for these terrorist acts. And I would call on all responsible states, particularly Middle East responsible states, to call this out for what it is. And to stand with the world in condemning, utterly condemning, these actions by Hamas.
I mean, first of all, just how ridiculous that is, 100% of it. But like, gendering Israel?
It's so bizarre. So bizarre. It's so it comes disgusting. Directly out of the Israeli embassy. Like, he's literally reading his memos, his scripts from the Israeli embassy.
She's a victim.
It's bizarre.
But
there's something in it, Nora, because it is this kind of gendered language. Like, Israel is a country being raped by these evil, sex maniac Palestinian rapists. You know, there's definitely something in that.
Yeah. Of course. And there he is saying it in plain language. Yes, Israel. I think he does. You know, she does have that right or whatever. And that is prosecutable in a world court. So I mean, these, you know, these scurrilous politicians are now just, they're doing reputation control, they're trying to save their own face, and meanwhile, you know, they're seeing all, if not more, images, that all the images and videos that we're all seeing. You know, they get situation reports.
Yeah, that was Matt Miller admitted. Remember, that's a few weeks ago we talked about former State Department spokesperson Matt Miller, who now has a lucrative job doing damage control for the world's worst companies and regimes at the Washington Lobby Group. And he said in that podcast interview with, I can't remember, I think it was a British publication, name escapes me now. But anyway, we talked about it. And he was asked, he said, were you seeing what everyone was seeing? He said, yes, we saw those images. And we may have seen things that were worse that the public didn't see. Right. So an admission that they knowingly aided and abetted these crimes. They knew what Israel was doing and what the result was. And the same is undoubtedly true for Keir Starmer, for Emmanuel Macron, who continues to aid and abet Israel. Remember, this guy who's promoting himself as a champion of a Palestinian state, every time Benjamin Netanyahu flies to Washington to collect more rewards from the United States, he's granted safe passage through French airspace, when what France is obligated to do is force his plane down and arrest him, hand him over to the International Criminal Court, not provide him with safe passage. And I just read today that Netanyahu is scheduled to visit Argentina, where President Milei is a fanatical Zionist. So Argentina will be the second country after Hungary to receive Netanyahu and presumably not arrest him as required by the International Criminal Court warrant. But let's watch and see between Israel and Argentina which countries aid and abet this genocide by providing its chief architect with safe passage through the airspace.
Yeah. Well, finally, you know, meanwhile, there are these new polls that are coming out. And over and over again, the global revulsion within international civil society is growing against this genocide, this Holocaust, and against the perpetuation of these crimes, with the encouragement of these leaders like Starmer and Trump and the Biden administration before him.
Yeah, I just thought we should end on a sort of a slightly uplifting note, which is that we have this new poll from Gallup that shows the headline is 32% in U.S. back Israel's military action in Gaza, a new low. Americans' approval of Israel's military action in Gaza has fallen 10 percentage points since the prior measurement in September, and it is now at 32%, the lowest reading since Gallup first asked the question in November 2023. Disapproval of the military action has now reached 60%. You should say that, I mean, it should be 0% support for Israel, but for the US, this is incredibly low to see a clear majority, 60%, opposing Israeli military action. And Gallup notes that Americans supported Israel's actions in Gaza in its initial poll in 2023, taken weeks after October 7th. But since then, disapproval has outpaced approval in each survey. So Israel's initial burst of support that it got faded very quickly and is now at this new low. They also point out that 52% of Americans, so a majority, now view Benjamin Netanyahu unfavorably, his highest unfavorable rating since 1997. Just 29% of American adults have a favorable rating of him. And that is really remarkable. And it's really a shift that is particularly visible among the youth, among 18 to 34 year olds. Just 6% of Americans support Israel's military action, as Gallup calls it, in Gaza, and just 9% view Netanyahu positively. And also one last point on this, that new Gallup survey also asked about Israel's military attack on Iran, and it found that currently 38% of Americans approve of it and 54% disapprove. So a majority of Americans disapprove of Donald Trump's attack on Iran.
Well, we'll see if any of that makes it into the policy decisions of those in power. You know, it's hard not to be cynical, because they're seeing this.
Right. And if this is public opinion in the United States, what is it in Europe? What is it in the rest of the world?
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. On a somewhat positive note, let's take a look at the website, Ali, if you want to gather the people's names, so that we can thank them publicly on air for their ongoing support of the Electronic Intifada and this live stream. There are some incredible features on the Electronic Intifada, as always. In the news report, I try to get to all of it, but I can't. And this week, I wasn't even able to get to the West Bank. There's so much that's happening in the West Bank. An activist, a local, very well-known activist in the town of Misafer Yatta in the South Hebron Hills, was shot and killed by a settler on camera in the past few days. And then the Israeli soldiers stormed the funeral of his family and forbade them from even mourning him. So we have an incredible feature, a news feature by a writer up there. It's the West Bank town of Sinjil, terrorized by settlers. Please go check that out, and as well as our new features by our writers in Gaza.
The piece by our colleague David Cronin is particularly moving, and it's he visited recently a what they call the Pauper Cemetery in County Wexford in Ireland, where many victims of the famine, the Great Hunger, or the Great Famine, were buried, people unknown, people victims of the genocidal colonial policies of Britain. And he draws some really moving and sharp comparisons with the Great Famine, the forced hunger in Gaza right now. So that's an incredibly moving piece.
Yes, please go check that out. Ali, tell us about some of the wonderful people who are supporting us.
Well, I can tell you about, what I can say is that everyone who supports us is wonderful, and we're very grateful to each and every one of you for all the ways you support us, for your messages, for being here and watching, for sharing the videos afterwards, for going out and speaking up for Palestine, for Gaza, for joining protests, for writing to your representatives, for doing all the things you do and more, and for helping us to educate the world about what's happening through supporting the Electronic Intifada. We are so grateful to each and every one of you, and to those who give financial gifts to help us do this work, to keep this independent, fearless journalism going. Thank you. So I'm just going to mention a few names. I wish I could mention everyone, but please know that we love and value and appreciate each and every one of you. So I'm going to thank Rachel, Gordon, Stefan, Gerald, Joanna, Daniel, Omar, Anya, Colin, Ahmed, and John Paul. It's just a very few of those of you who we're so grateful for your support. And if you want to support our work, you can go to the website and click donate now. You can make a one-time gift, or you can make a monthly gift. If that makes it easier. Again, only do it if you can afford it, if you're not going to be doing it at the expense of important needs that you or a family member or a loved one has. We just want those of you who can afford to support us to do so, so we can share this information with everyone. It's always free for everyone. We will never ask anyone to subscribe in order to access this information.
That's right. Thank you, Ali. Thank you to everyone. I especially want to thank Tamara Nassar for directing and producing. We missed you, and we're really glad you're back. Thanks to Ellie Gerzon, of course, for filling in for Tamara last week, and for all the production and social media, all the things you do, Ellie. Thank you also to our staff at the Electronic Intifada, everyone who's involved in editing and publishing everything that we do. Thanks also to Pierre Loisel, who puts together the radio program for EI. And on behalf of myself, John, Asa, Ali, and Tamara, thank you all, and we will see you next week. We'll be right back.